Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio. We're on location with Good Growing with the Garden Guy. I'm your host, Tom Majeur, with my sister, Sue Majeur. Sue, how are you doing in Kalamazoo?
I am sorry that I'm missing you live, but I'm still glad to be here.
All right. Hey, we're on location, but we're not in the tomato patch. We are in the ad building of Great Lakes Adventist Academy recording this particular program, and we have Gary, and we're doing something very special, Gary.
What are we doing?
We're doing, for the very first time ever, we're doing it before a live audience. You're a pro at this, but for us, this is a first of firsts.
So, well, we'll find out.
We'll find out. So, great. Sue, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
Okay. Heavenly Father, thank you for this marvelous opportunity to be able to do this live at camp meeting, which is also a special blessing, and also for us to learn yet more about your endless and marvelous creations, which is a reflection of your character so that we can understand you better. So we thank you for all of these blessings. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen. One of the reasons we're doing this is we have a live audience. We've never been able to get people inside of our studio, but in our studio audience here, we have 2, 4, 6, rows of 6, 2, 4, 6, 8. We have about 48 people here with questions that will take the whole hour, so we hope. We'll see. So the idea is in the seat that I'm sitting in is the hot seat, and you can come and bring questions and share them. But Gary, why don't you I thought maybe that with the questions that you have before at the beginning of each program, if you stump the panel, which is Sue, my sister Sue, and I, we can go to the audience.
Do a poll the audience question.
That's right. We're going to poll the audience. So, Gary, why don't you throw the first question? My sister Sue, she really reads a lot more than I do. So, I call her the armchair gardener. She's the person who reads about what I should be doing, and she sends me out to do it in my garden. So,
yeah, we should keep a record of who gets the most answers.
There's no question. She gets the most answers. Yeah. So, what's the first question, Gary?
This is the tomato quiz. And the first question is, which U.S. state claims the tomato is both a fruit and a vegetable? And it is a multiple choice question.
Oh, good.
So your choices are California.
California.
Arkansas.
Arkansas.
Texas.
Texas.
Florida.
Florida.
And you can't ask the audience.
Okay, Sue, it's just you and me against the world.
I'm going to guess because Arkansas can be quirky, so I'm going to pick Arkansas.
What do you say, Tom?
Well, they sure make a lot of grow a lot of tomatoes in Florida and Texas. So I'm going to say Texas.
Is that your final answer?
That is my final answer.
Way to go, Sue. Skunked again.
That's
Tom.
Right.
Okay, number two. What pigment gives tomatoes their red color?
Lycopene. Okay.
Lycopene.
Yeah, that was my guess.
Beta carotene or anthocyanin.
We have a unanimous answer of lycopene.
Lycopene. That's good. Good.
Okay. Yeah. We're not quite even yet. Okay.
All right. Next one should be easy.
Okay.
If you think of the history of some of the questions I've asked, which country leads the world in tomato production? Is it Italy, the United States, China, or India?
Well,
China.
We always guess China. It's like the no-fault answer.
Yeah, that would be a pretty good answer. That's right. Okay, number four. On average, how many pounds of fresh tomatoes does the average American consume yearly? Is it 10 pounds, 20 pounds, 31 pounds, or 40 pounds?
Well, I'm going to say 20. What are you thinking, Sue?
I'm thinking the 31, or because, I mean, we eat tomatoes not just like on our salads, but we eat it like on pizza and on spaghetti and lasagna and all these other kind of things when it's cooked as well as raw.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with the 31.
Okay, we got a split decision.
If you know how to take a test, you'll notice that all of them are even, like 10, 20, 40, and the answer is 31. So even if you had no idea, I would have zeroed in on that number.
So I heard
he has tomatoes and he grows so many.
Yes, I did about 1,000 pounds 3 years in a row. So
1,000.
Wow. Yeah, little. I had 300 plants.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, number five. What group of explorers first introduced the tomato to Europe in the 16th century? Is it the Vikings, the British, the Spanish conquistadors, or the Portuguese?
Oh, the Spanish conquistadors. They remember Tom and Precious Cargo.
That's correct.
That's exactly correct. Okay, now this one might get you. What was the original color of most wild tomatoes? Was it red, yellow, purple, or green?
I don't think it's red. That's just too obvious.
That would be good.
That's kind of a default thing, too, isn't it? I'm wavering between red or yellow.
I was thinking yellow.
I'll take the red just to be traditional.
Oh, okay. Sue, your brother got you on that one. It's yellow.
How come red?
Tom, he's got it. And I actually am fond of the yellow, more fond of the yellow tomatoes. So
how come the red seemed to have the predominance of the market?
It's all breeding.
But yeah. I mean, it must be out of consumer demand.
Well, also, red is a really nice color that attracts people for food.
Right.
Think of a yellow strawberry.
Yuck.
It doesn't really look very good. So, okay, this one is
all those pine berries that we learned about were quite tasty.
Yeah, but they're not yellow.
They're white.
They're more white to slight pink.
Yeah.
See, I don't think I would want to eat a yellow strawberry. But somebody will produce one day. Okay, number seven. What tomato variety holds the Guinness World Book of Records for the heaviest tomato? Is it the Brandywine, the Domingo, Big Zack, or Beefsteak?
I think it's going to be the Brandywine or the Beefsteak.
The audience is saying Beefsteak by popular demand. I need to have a dartboard.
Well,
I don't know.
What's your guess? You don't know?
I have no idea.
We're polling the audience, and what is the audience saying?
Beefsteak is the audience's answer.
Well, the answer is Domingo, which I've never seen that variety. It set a world's record at 10.795 pounds back in 2020 in Walla Walla, Washington.
That's almost a season's worth of tomatoes in one tomato.
But
it's like the size of a baby.
Really? But there's more. According to the Guinness World Book of Records, the overall heaviest tomato ever recorded is slightly higher, 11.65 pounds, grown by, it doesn't say the name of the guy, but it was at the Stillwater Harvest Fest, October 8th, 2022. Those are some heavy tomatoes.
Yeah, that's right.
Domingo. I've not seen that variety, so I've never even seen it in a catalog. So
can you bring that next month? Anyway.
I'm going to see if I can find it and see how big they get.
Can you imagine picking one of, have you had those in your garden regularly? Say, yes, dear, I'd like some pizza for sauce and canning the next 2 weeks. Could you bring up
here.
Tomato?
It's probably about this big.
Well, you know, it's a lot like Blue Jardale pumpkins were 10 to about 14 pounds, so yeah, 16.
Okay, now we know there's a tomato fight in Europe. Here's one for the U.S. Which city is famous for its annual tomato fight or food wasting fest? Is it Austin, Texas, Reno, Nevada, Columbia, South Carolina, or Brooklyn, New York?
Okay, audience, I'm listening.
One more time.
Austin, Texas, Reno, Nevada, Columbia, South Carolina, or Brooklyn, New York?
New York.
The audience is divided.
it's one you wouldn't expect. Reno, Nevada.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm going to pick South Carolina.
Well, you don't want to do that because I just told you it was Reno.
Oh, well, you break it up a little bit.
Oh, sorry. All right, so number 9. What chemical in tomatoes can reduce the risk of prostate cancer? This is only of interest to the guys.
Yeah, I know. I want to say it's lipopene, but it's not lipopene. I've heard it.
You want to hear your choices?
Yes, 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 please. Thank you.
Flavonoids, lycopene, vitamin C, selenium.
Lycopene.
What do you say, Sue?
Well, yeah, they keep talking about the antioxidant powers of lycopene, so I guess I'll go with that.
That's correct, lycopene. Okay, number 10. Which part of the tomato plant is toxic to humans if eaten? The seeds, the fruit skin, that was a dumb one, leaves and stems, or juice?
The leaves and stems.
Yeah, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah. Because
we eat the seeds, we eat the skins, and we drink the juice. So, that was a gimme.
Although I had in my garden last week, I had three in my greenhouse, I had three of them, something took the complete leaves off of plants were about 8 inches high, so I hope it's toxic.
Well, poison is a matter of dose and how big you are.
Okay.
So you can eat a little bit of something and not hurt you, but it's a matter of how much you get. And plus, animals can eat certain things that we can't.
That's true.
So, for instance, birds eat the poison ivy berries. I wouldn't recommend it. All right, number 11. What famous U.S. founding father is credited in helping popularize the tomato in North America?
Okay.
Is it Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, or John Adams?
Jefferson.
It's
gotta be him.
It has to
now,
be.
Now, are you being an echo to Sue?
No.
He was a young man, but a young gardener.
Yes, it was Thomas Jefferson. Okay, number 12. Why do store-bought tomatoes often lack strong flavor compared to garden-grown ones? Is it A, they use artificial ripening gas, less ethylene? Are they bred for shelf life and not taste? Are they harvested too early? They contain fewer seeds.
I was thinking the same thing.
Well, harvesting too early could do that, but it's number 2. They're bred for shelf life.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, about 8 or 9 years ago, when they were looking at the genetics, they found out that those tomatoes that produce green shoulders,
okay,
one of the things they did is they bred that out of the tomatoes, and it also bred the nutrition out too. Not all of it, but some of it.
It's not good.
No, not at all. Number 13, what vitamins are tomatoes especially rich in? This is the gimme too. Is it vitamin B12, C, D, or K?
Well, the audience is saying C.
Probably it's got to be C or K.
Yeah, it's C, and you don't get vitamin B12 from plant sources. So, number 14, how many tomato varieties are estimated to exist worldwide?
Thousands, I bet, if it's anything like...
Your choices are...
Or pears.
500, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 plus.
I'm going to... You have to either...
10,000.
Read the question again.
How many tomato varieties are estimated to exist worldwide? A, 500, B, 1,000, C, 5,000, D, 10,000 plus.
Wow. I know I read, she says 10,000. I read, there's this wonderful book on the Vegetable Bible or something like that, and I was just totally amazed at the number of potatoes and the number of tomatoes. It's got to be a huge number, but I'm going to be a little bit shy and say 1,000.
You should have followed Sue.
Okay. I always should listen to Sue.
Yeah.
And you know what? This morning they said that the younger sister is usually the old loudest. So I guess it's true.
Yeah, because you aren't heard otherwise.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, last chance, Tom. Number 15. What fruit is the close botanical relative of the tomato? Is it bell pepper? Is it eggplant? Is it celery? Or is it melons?
It's definitely not celery. It's definitely not melons. I think I like the eggplant.
Eggplant. For the pepper.
Yeah, both it's eggplant.
We've got some gardeners in the audience here.
Yeah, oh yeah. Good job. Good job.
Well, fancy. Well, Gary, there's a couple questions over on the side of the table as we close out this segment. Let me take a look. Do you want to read them or do you
no,
want
go
me
ahead.
To? Okay. It says, how much should you thin pumpkins and watermelons? You put extra ones to make sure you get a harvest. What is the...
Well, as you know, they'll continue to set fruit as far as we go into the season. And with watermelons, for instance, you have to think about how long does it take to produce that watermelon. And if you have something setting flowers in July in Michigan, you're never going to get it. So you might as well take those off. That way, the ones that remain will get the energy that's going into the plant. Same thing with melons. When you get to about midsummer, I wouldn't bother.
There's a cutoff point.
Yeah. Now, some things will naturally abort, but most of the time, I don't take mine off.
Okay.
They just don't ripen.
Okay. Here's a couple other questions from the audience, and then we'll go to the break. This comes from Renee Coffee, and she says, when should we put up shade cloth in our hoop house? I bought some, but I have not installed it yet, so I agree. I want to know the answer to this one.
Yeah, Renee. June. Because it gets really hot in a greenhouse.
Because we got full sun.
Yeah. When I used to work in the greenhouse, they didn't use shade cloth. They used a whitewash on the glass, and that was usually put on in June.
Okay. Very good. And the follow-up question, what temperature is too hot in the hoop house? I've heard a number. I'm just curious what you...
Well, plants can take very high temperatures, but it depends on what's in there. For instance, if you were growing tomatoes in a hot house and you were exceeding over 100 degrees in there, you're not going to get pollination.
Okay.
So, but you can keep plants over 100 degrees and they'll survive as long as they have sufficient moisture.
And moisture is
and
the key, right?
Something like watermelon, no problem.
Give them as much as they want.
Yeah. Warm season crops are much more tolerant than cool season crops.
Very good. And I also think the duration of heat. I mean, we went on a Sabbath afternoon. We went to church. We were in a hurry to go to church. We forgot to put up the sides. Mm-hmm. And we went to church. And then we had potluck. And then we went visiting. And all of a sudden, oh, no, the sun is out. And I didn't open up the greenhouse.
Yeah, and it got like a sauna in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when you have that kind of heat, you might have to water twice a day.
Okay. So that could be a remedy or mm-hmm. a mediating factor.
Yeah, moisture makes a big difference because if I just go one day with my greenhouse and we have seedlings in there, they'll be drooping by the end of the day. May not be dead, but they'll be drooping.
Will they come back?
It depends on how long they've been dry and how large the plants are. Very small plants generally won't, but the big ones will.
Very good. We're going to go to a break. You're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and a studio audience of growing. It's almost 50 people, and we're just enjoying this. And this may become a regular here, Gary. We'll see what happens.
Well, we'll see.
Okay, hold on. We'll be right back after this break.
Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, surely I am coming quickly. We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087 on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back, and we're with Good Growing with the Garden Guy at Great Lakes Adventist Academy. We're at the Michigan Camp Meeting in June. We're recording the July program with Gary Heilig, our expert, and also with Sue Majeure, my co-host in Kalamazoo. And we're having Audience Participation Day. And so we have about 50 people in our audience, and Diane Brewer has a question that she submitted in advance. Diane, would you read your question for Gary?
Okay, I have a cherry tree that is loaded with blossoms and then cherries in the spring, but they rot and fall off before they mature. And last year I did some research on what to do, and I thought maybe it might be brown rot, and so I cleaned up everything under the tree, got rid of it, burned it, and sprayed the tree with a fungicide, and this year the same thing's happening. What can I do?
What did it look like?
The cherries would just kind of shrivel up and they turn a brown color.
They don't have that fine puffy material on it?
No, just...
That wouldn't be brown rot. In order to tell you exactly what that is, I'd have to see it, because you gave me such a general bit of information, I can't really tell what it is. But with cherries, there are a number of different fungal diseases that they can have, and you have to use preventative sprays starting fairly early. And we normally start preventative sprays on cherries when the leaves first start coming out. It's not a problem with pollinators, because they're not toxic to pollinators, the fungicides aren't. So there are a number of products that you can use, but I really need to find out what the disease is. So what I usually tell people to do when they have a situation like that is take a picture of it and email it to me, and it's easier to diagnose, and then I can tell you what the proper thing would be to use for it. Now, do you grow stuff organically or not?
Pretty much,
okay.
Yes.
That tends to limit what you can do, because there aren't as many fungicides available that would be effective on a wide range of diseases. There are some organic fungicides that'll be good for certain diseases on fruits, but not everything. For instance, Captan is not organic, but it is a wide-ranging material which will cover more diseases. But I need to know what it is first, so if you could take a picture of it and send it to my email, and I'll give you my email during the program. Or
give it to her now.
Yeah, it's my last name, Heilig, and you have something she can write with, because she's not going to remember.
Yes, sir.
So it's H-E-I-L-I-G.
Oops.
H-E-I-L-I-G at MSU dot E-D-U. And anybody that wants to do that, I do it for free. You just give me some good pictures, close pictures. Show me the entire plant if you can, if it's something that I need to see the whole plant. But make sure the close-up pictures are clear, and I can diagnose it that way, and then I'll send you the information.
Okay, thank you.
At no charge.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Diane. And you, the one thing I can say is that Gary is making this to all of you. He really enjoys answering these questions, and some of these questions may show up on a future program. Let's also talk about vegetables. We're going to talk about August vegetables that you harvest and their effect on inflammation. Now, there's some nightshades. I think I'm preempting the question a little bit. But nightshades have inflammatory properties.
Well, one of the things that I was interested in as I was getting toward the end of my career in extension was nutrition and what happens to nutrients, and also about inflammation in terms of a lot of the diseases we have are due to inflammation. And there are foods that are more inflammatory and other foods that are less inflammatory. So that means if you eat something like sweet potatoes and you have certain inflammatory issues, it can help it. It won't necessarily clear it up, but it'll help it. And so I did a little research, and there's certain anti-inflammatory vegetables that you can grow that if you do have some of these problems, it will help. And for instance, leafy greens like Swiss chard. And you hear all this stuff, like Vicky used to say, eat those dark green leafy vegetables. Well, that's one of the reasons why. And also broccoli and cabbage, they have certain anti-inflammatory materials in it. If you're interested, there's one called sulforaphane, and also beets. How many people like beets? Oh, that's pretty good for this room. And they also help not only reduce inflammation, but help with circulation. Cucumbers, and they're mildly anti-inflammatory, and also green beans. And a lot of these things are less inflammatory because of the antioxidants that they have in them. And one of the things that you can do that I love to do for research and when I'm looking for things is, are you familiar with AI? Artificial intelligence. You've probably heard of Google Gemini, ChatGPT. It's like having a conversation with an expert. So you can go and ask it just about anything. For instance, I was going to work on my rototiller, and I knew the name of it. It was a 25th anniversary Troy-Bilt silver whatever. And I was too lazy to go downstairs and look for the book because I have boxes and boxes of books. And so I asked ChatGPT, and I said, what's the model number, and what do I need for oil, what do I need for gear oil, and what do I need for this? It just spit it all out because it just went to the internet and pulled all that information down. You can do the same thing with gardening stuff, because that's what I did when I was looking for this information on inflammation. Some of the most inflammatory things that you can eat, Tom already mentioned one, is the nightshades. Tomatoes, eggplant, even though they're good nutrients in them, they tend to inflame. So those, it's not that you don't eat them, it's that you either eat fewer amounts of them or you mix them with vegetables that are anti-inflammatory. And some others include peppers, both bell and hot, and I happen to love hot peppers, and eggplant, sweet corn to a certain extent is. Onions and garlic cause some other problems. They tend to cause digestive inflammation and cause difficulty for some people. So these are some of the things that you can do. And if say, for instance, you're checking with ChatGPT or some of the other AIs and they just give you some examples, you can ask it, do you have anything else for me, any more? And they'll even make charts for you and tell you why they are anti-inflammatory and what chemicals they have in them. So it's very useful information.
Does cooking affect
cooking doesn't really affect whether they're inflammatory or not, that I know of, but cooking can affect the nutrient contents, though.
And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. I'm just surprised when you said sweet corn. That just doesn't seem to be on the list.
Well, one of the reasons sweet corn is a problem, it has what's called a high glycemic index. In other words, it has lots of sugar in it. And it will raise your blood sugar. And sugar is very inflammatory. So I wish I would have learned this a long time ago, because one of the things I used to do when I went to Michigan State in the morning is I would stop by Quality Dairy and buy a donut and orange juice. Oh, yeah. Well, anyway.
You're paying for it now.
Oh, yeah, I'm paying for it. But anyway, the sugar, especially processed sugars, aren't good for you. Sugars that you find in fruits, as long as you don't eat too much, are okay. Because the sugar in fruits are called fructose. And the sugar that we eat in various prepared materials, like donuts, is sucrose. It may have some fructose depending on what kind of dessert it is, but they're not great for you in large amounts.
Let's talk about nutrition, about how to preserve nutrients in your produce. What are the best methods of preserving the nutrients? They aren't all created equal.
Now, one of the things that I was interested in too was I did a program when I was at Michigan State, and I talked about preserving nutrients from the time that you selected the variety that you grew, because not all tomatoes or not all carrots have the same levels of nutrients in them. And so I looked at from the time you started your plant to the condition of your soil, because the nutrients that end up in the plants have to come from somewhere. The minerals like calcium and some of the other things are pulled out of the soil and go into the plant. But the vitamins are actually made inside the plant. But if they don't have the building blocks, then the plant can't produce the nutrients. So then I looked at what happens when you harvest the nutrients. How long does vitamin C last? Because, you know, when we buy broccoli in the stores during the winter months, it's coming from Mexico or it's coming from California, and it has to be shipped across the country. Well, how stable are the nutrients when we do that? And then I also looked at what happens when you cook it, because we cook in various ways. We steam, we pan fry, we deep fry, hopefully not very often, cooking with oil, cooking with water, we freeze, we dry, and then dehydration. All of those things can have an effect. Of course, the best way to eat it is as quickly as possible, and in the fresh state in most cases. Now, in the case of tomatoes, that's a little bit different. You get better nutrient content from some of the nutrients from cooking. So, for instance, when you eat something fresh, there's no damage from heat. And when you eat it right away, there's no degradation because, for instance, broccoli, when it's shipped from California, within 2 or 3 days, you've lost about 50% or more of the vitamin C. So even though you say, boy, I'm eating broccoli and I'm getting all these nutrients. Well, no, you're not. You're getting only some of the nutrients. Now, steaming is really good because you're not soaking something in water. And there are what we call water-soluble vitamins that when you're boiling something, those nutrients will go into the water. And when we grew up, we used to eat greens like collard greens, mustard greens, turnip greens, and the liquid was called I just wanted to give people a chance. It's called pot liquor, and there are nutrients in that stuff, and I used to drink it because it was really good. I liked it. So when you, say, steam something, which is how we do most of our vegetables like broccoli, we don't boil hardly anything, you preserve not only the nutrients but also the texture and, in a lot of cases, the color of the things. Now, I didn't mention microwaving. But microwaving is not bad. A lot of times we hear about microwaving is bad, and there are some situations where microwaving can be bad because of the plastics that you might use but for the containers. But for the most part, you're not using very much water, so the nutrients stay in there. And basically, microwaves jiggle the water molecules in the plant, and that's how it heats up. And for the amount of time that you're microwaving, the nutrients will stay pretty stable. So that's not a bad way to go. But then we have sauteing and stir frying. And how much you lose depends on how long you're stir frying something. And that's one of the things I like about Chinese food. They just stir fry just long enough so that you still have the crispiness of the vegetables, but they're somewhat tender. That's a really good way of cooking. And also the oil that you use can make a difference too. So if you're using olive oil or avocado oil, those are the best oils. And they tend to absorb the fat-soluble vitamins like A, D, E, and K. But you don't want to overdo it because processed oils aren't necessarily good for you either. So you want to use moderate time and moderate heat and healthy oils if you're going to do that. Now, boiling, you can lose between 50 and 70% of the water-soluble nutrients like vitamin C in the process of boiling. Now, what we'll do, what Jess will do when we're boiling something, she'll save that water and use it as a soup base so that you're not necessarily losing all the nutrients. Now, with minerals, when we're talking about minerals, we're talking about calcium and iron and molybdenum and manganese and a lot of things that most people don't even think about. Those are stable. Those are elements, and you can do whatever you want to them, and they're going to still be there. You might move them out someplace, but they're still going to be there. Deep frying, bad news. With the high temperatures, you lose your antioxidants, you destroy your vitamins, and also, and I'm guilty of this, I absolutely love French fries. But when you fry potatoes, you make something called acrylamides, which is really bad for you. So eat those things as little as possible. And I'm still working on that because Gary loves him some French fries. Yes?
Is it the same as air frying?
Air frying is a little different because air frying, you don't get the development of the acrylamides. It's the grease and the heat that causes the acrylamides to be made. When you freeze something, you have minimal loss of nutrients. And even fermenting can be good. Does anybody like kimchi? I had tasted for the first time kimchi fried rice, and I couldn't believe how really good that was. I liked it. But fermenting preserves vitamin C, and also you'll get what's called probiotics that develop. I don't know all the details of that because I didn't go into research that very deeply. But fermenting can be good in certain cases, but, you know, you gotta not overdo it. Like pickles, for instance, tend to be very salty. You need to be careful about that. Now, drying and dehydrating, you will lose some vitamins, but vitamin C is the one that you're going to lose, but you can get vitamin C out of a rock. This is a joke. But it's great for minerals, and it preserves the fiber. So if you're drying or dehydrating, and that's the dehydrating is those machines that you buy that you've probably seen the commercials where you can dehydrate just about everything, ice cream to meat, and then you just add water back to it.
So you're talking about freeze-drying.
Freeze-drying, yeah. That's what I was trying to remember. And so that's great for minerals and the fibers. Now, canning is good for shelf life, but nutrients will be lost due to the heat, and you can lose some nutrients over time depending on how long you're keeping things on the shelf. So it's best, if you want the best nutrient content, is to grow it in your backyard, pick it, bring it in, and do minimal cooking to it. And that's going to do a lot better than anything else.
So, Gary, we have some questions out there in the studio. Does anybody want to step up to the mic with that question? Jesusa? This is kind of a family discussion
now,
here.
This is my wife. You guys haven't guessed. We've been married over 50 years.
How about market?
She didn't throw me out either.
How about market food? Is it like rude to ask the person, when did you pick this?
No, it's not rude. They don't mind telling you in most cases. But from working with farmers markets, many times people have picked that morning, really early in the morning, and they're selling it that day. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some things they'll keep over. Like, for instance, pumpkins. You can keep pumpkins or apples or some of those things, and you're not going to lose many nutrients over the period of 2 or 3 days.
Well, we went to the market for about 3 years, and we would tell people we picked these this morning. And that was a big selling. And we picked them in the morning, washed them up, took them to the market in the afternoon. So I said, this is as good as you're going to get unless you're growing your own, right? So
yeah.
Great comment. And we're going to hold our answers for the next section here. Gary, I got one question before we continue that. What you alluded to it about the stability of particular nutrients. What are some of the most unstable and some of the most stable ones?
Probably the water-soluble ones are the most unstable. Vitamin A, vitamin C, yeah. The nurse is the one that knows more about the vitamins than I do. But those are the ones that are the most unstable.
Very good. We'll be coming back after the break. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy from the campus of Great Lakes Adventist Academy here at the Michigan Conference. We've got a live audience of 50-some-odd people, and you're hearing their response. We have Sue Majeure on the line and your host, Tom Majeure. We'll be right back after this.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button or call 231-468-2087. We thank you and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
Yeah, we don't have a live audience in the room, so we pick topics. So if you have something you want to say, just come on up here and do it. We'll throw out all the other stuff we're talking about.
This is fantastic. I'm going to go ahead and start this third section. We're going to clap my hands. Hey, you guys going to help me? 1, 2, 3. I sure hope we caught that on the recording. That was the live audience. You heard all of them clap their hands at the same time. It's Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilake, Sue Majeure, and your host, Tom Majeure. We're here at the Great Lakes Adventist Academy at the Michigan Camp Meeting with a live audience. We have some questions here. I did make an error, and at the top that Carol Marsh did the
earlier question, and I have a question from Diane Brewer, but if somebody else wants to step up to the seat, they get to be next. And look at them run! What about using flour such as rice and oats for fertilizer?
Well, flour from oats for fertilizer?
Grind it.
Well, all plant materials will have some nutrients in them. It's not going to be high in terms of concentration. Like when you buy a fertilizer, and I'll use commercial fertilizers as an example. When you buy a bag of 10-10-10, it's 10% by weight of an actual nitrogen material, 10% phosphorus, 10% potassium. If you bought an organic source, you're going to have lower nutrients because they might use bone meal in it, mm-hmm. in the mixture, which is 2% nitrogen, 11% phosphorus, 0% potash, or you might use green sand, which is 0.05% potassium. And if you were to use flour, you're going to be on the low end of the nutrients, but it will provide some nutrients. But it would not be enough to give you the highest production.
A follow-up question also from Diane is, what about using, we're still in fertilizer, mm-hmm. talking about yeast and water mixtures for fertilizers?
Well, the one thing that I know that yeast do when they are exposed to a carbohydrate is they give off carbon dioxide. Now, plants use carbon dioxide in the process of photosynthesis in order to make sugars, but that's drawn from the air. And I can't think of anything else the yeast would really provide. So I don't know if I would really use that. That one I'd have to do a little research on, but I just don't see where it would make much of a difference.
Now, for some prevention.
Yes?
Yes, Gary, Sue's got a question.
Following up on the first lady's question about the flour, is it also something that we have to concern about the glyphosate-free? I mean, now that we know more, that's a thing. Is that something that we need to be concerned about in our products that we are using secondhand, I guess you would say, in our gardens?
You mean using glyphosate in the garden, or are we talking about Roundup resistant plants or what?
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is so many things now that they'll say, okay, they're non-GMO when you're reading a package in the store. Mm-hmm. They'll say non-GMO, and we're all like, oh, yay, organic, yay. But now that they've found out how bad glyphosate is, and they'll say, we didn't use that in the growing, but it turns out that they can say that they did not use it in the growing, but they'll use it to dry it off at harvest time. So you're still getting it. So is this, and let's say that I bought oats that did not say glyphosate free, and I use that, you know, in an application in my garden or something. This is something we have to be concerned about, is it?
Well, all the things that you just said is going to take a while to explain. First of all, when you say GMO, you're talking about a genetically modified organism. And ever since we started breeding, we've genetically modified organisms. It's just that the way it's being done now is differently. Now, what you're talking about is Roundup or glyphosate resistant plants, where they're modified in such a way that when a farmer goes over the field and sprays glyphosate, the plant is able to survive it because glyphosate is a general kill down material. So yeah, there'll be some exposure to it, but the other thing you have to think about is how long does it take for glyphosate to break down? And glyphosate is basically hydrogen, carbon, there might be some phosphorus on the organic structure, and bacteria and sunlight will break these things down. But the question is, how long does it take? And that's something that I would have to research. Glyphosate is in the news because it's believed to cause certain types of cancers, like leukemia. And there's been some lawsuits about that, and they're still in the courts right now. And so if you can avoid it, I would. And as far as whether or not somebody has sprayed, the only way you can tell is to talk to the farmer.
I'm wondering about it because I did see a gardening show where this guy said that he had been using, I think it was horse manure as fertilizer that he had gotten from a friend or something.
And the field had been sprayed with glyphosate?
Well, the hay that the horse was consuming had it in there, mm-hmm. hence it was in its droppings, and hence it went into his previously organic garden, which upset him a great deal, and he said it did affect the plants that he was trying to grow. So I was just wondering, is this something that, you know, has some kind of incredibly long half-life, and, you know, you get cow manure or fertilizer from somewhere.
Yeah,
you don't know this.
You can look up. You can look up the half life, and what I mean by half life for people that don't know, is let's say for instance, this book, and we want to know what the half life is. How long does it take for this book to break down? So if the half life was 50 days, that meant that half of this book will be gone in 50 days. Another 50 days, another half of that half would be gone, and it just keeps getting smaller and smaller until it's no longer distinguishable. You can look up the half-life of Roundup. Talk to chat. It will tell you what the half-life of Roundup is. In terms of the horse, when, say, for instance, a field has been sprayed with glyphosate and the horse eats it, depends on how long ago that glyphosate was sprayed as to how much the horse would consume. But you have to remember there are all kinds of bacteria in the horse's digestive gut, and they're going to start breaking that stuff down too. But for an organic farmer, that's a problem, because if a person brings in something that is not certified organic, then whatever they're feeding it to is no longer organic, or whatever it's been sprayed on is no longer organic, and that's a problem. But just as a little side note, when we talk about buying things that are certified organic, there's a lot of cheating going on. Mm-hmm. So you need to know your grower.
Let me ask you this question. I used to drive through southern Ontario. That's called the Banana Belt of Ontario. That's the warmest part of all of Canada, and they do a lot of growing, and they grow tomatoes over there. And I drove by one time, and the fields were that you saw ripe tomatoes all over the ground, and all the foliage was completely dead. What did they use to knock down all that green foliage?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know everything, Tom.
Oh my.
Normally there's no reason for them to kill the foliage in order to harvest. I can't think of a reason why they would need to do that.
Well, they did. So we have a question over here.
Check it out and see what I can find out, and okay. We'll talk about it next month.
It was on the fields of Heinz tomatoes, so they were bound for Heinz. But we have a guest.
Leamington.
Yes.
The tomato capital of the world.
Amen, at least of North America. I know this gentleman. Give me your name and what your question for the garden guy.
Jim Tiffany.
That's right.
What's your feeling about hydroponically grown vegetables? And if you, as a follow-up question, if you were to go to a grocery store and you wanted to avoid hydroponic tomatoes, for example, what would you do to get soil-grown tomatoes?
Well, what hydroponic means is it's soilless culture. And usually what they do, and it depends on the crop, let's use strawberries, for instance. They'll have it in a container. They'll have a nutrient solution, and they'll run through that all the nutrients that they know that strawberries use. And they just eliminate the soil. Now, the advantages of that is you avoid having soil-borne diseases, and that's kind of nice because you don't lose as many strawberries to things like botrytis. In terms of whether it's better or worse, I've never read anything that said hydroponic was any less nutritious than things grown in the soil, because the soil basically is just the what we call a substrate, and nutrients are attached to the particles, like the particles of clay, the particles of organic matter. Nutrients don't attach to sand at all, or particles of silt. And it's a give and take situation. The soil holds the nutrients, it releases the nutrients when the plants need it. But I can't think of anything that I've read that says hydroponic is inferior in terms of nutrients. But you just gave me another topic for next month to research. So okay. I'll double check it.
Well, I'll follow up with a thought I have, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm not an expert, but I've sat in soils classes where they explain all the amazingly complex biological dynamics that happen in soil. And my thinking is, okay, so this is man's attempt to replicate what God has provided. So how can it be as good? That's just my thought. But I'm not a scientist.
For instance, we have various bacteria in the soil that are breaking down materials. For instance, there are saprophytic bacteria, mesophytic bacteria, thermophytic bacteria, and they're all involved in decomposition of organic matter. When that organic matter is decomposed, it releases nutrients, and then the plants can pick those nutrients up. There are other bacteria that will release what would be called gums. There's a material called geosmin that's released by bacteria that helps hold the soil particles together. And so there are all kinds of things that go on there that help the soil, but it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the uptake or release of nutrients. So there's a lot of things going on. You're right, it's very, very complex, and I don't know all of it either. But I don't know of any connection between nutrient content in hydroponics versus soil grown, but I'm going to be checking for next month, so make sure you're listening.
Sounds great. Thank you for your answers.
Thank you, Jim. We have a question here. What dark green leafy vegetables do you suggest for Michigan, and what are the best protected from pests? You know, the pests like to chew on those dark green leafy vegetables.
Yeah, you know what? The insects know what's good for them. Sometimes we don't. Swiss chard is really great, beet greens, spinach. I like all of the different dark leafy greens that you use in Chinese things like bok choy and pak choy and all those sorts of things.
Mustards and collards.
Pardon?
Mustards and collards.
Oh yeah, collard greens are probably one of the best things you can eat. And, pardon?
The butterflies from laying the eggs.
Well, I'll tell you what you can do. One of the things that I do, and I'll give you an example using cabbage.
The question is, how do you keep the moths from collecting and eating those delicious, nutritious green things?
Mm-hmm. I'll use cabbage as an example. What we did, I did an experiment where I wanted to do as little work on it as possible. So I put the cabbage in the ground. After we planted that, I put a collar around the cabbage, which would take care of the cutworms, because cutworms have to wrap themselves around the stem in order to cut it off. Then I put down coffee grounds. Coffee grounds contain caffeine. Slugs eat it, and the caffeine kills them. Then I put down a straw mulch, which took care of the weeds. Then we put row covers over that. You know what a row cover is? A row cover, it's sort of like a
cheesecloth.
Yeah, like a cheesecloth. They come in different thicknesses, and they let about 90% of the air in, or all the air and 90% of sunlight, all the water, so you don't have to water, you don't have to lift it up or do anything. And we covered it over so that those butterflies cannot physically get to the plants. And of course, it keeps the rabbits off, keeps the deer off, because they won't go under it. And all I had to do when we were growing that cabbage was lift up and see how it's going and say it's not ready yet and put it back down. We had to do no spraying, no weeding, no watering, no nothing. Pardon?
Drip hose.
Yeah, we had drip hose down for irrigation, for supplemental irrigation. And you could do that with all the greens. And if they can't get to it, they can't eat it. We didn't have problems with woodchucks going under it or anything. Now, the little bugs, that would be something like flea beetles, for instance. And flea beetles are usually a problem when you first plant. Now, that one you'd probably have to put something down if you have a flea beetle problem. But I would use something like spinosad, which is an organic product, or a rotenone pyrethrum combination, or neem. All those things are organic, and they'll take care of the flea beetles. But other than that, if you did those other things, you'll have to do very little work.
Okay, we're coming towards the end of this program, but we have two questions that are of similar vein. One is, what is the best fertilizer for organic gardening, and which brand do you recommend?
Well, I don't get into recommending brands, because most organic fertilizers are naturally derived substances. For instance, examples of nitrogen might be a soybean meal. Or as I mentioned before, bone meal will have 2% nitrogen. There are a number of different things. Now, how much you need and what you need is based on a soil test. And then once you get that soil test back, it'll tell you how much phosphorus, how much potassium you need to put down, how much nitrogen you need. Nitrogen is something we recommend as a general thing, because so many things happen to nitrogen in the environment. Phosphorus and potassium are more stable. Now, so what you do once you get that soil test result back, then you try to find a fertilizer that matches those needs. And for instance, when I talked about 10-10-10, that's a balanced fertilizer. It has all three and it's equal amounts. What I normally like to do is I will take the individual nutrients and apply them based on what the need is. So I'll find a phosphorus source, and wood ashes can be a phosphorus source as long as you don't use too much of them, because it tends to drive your pH up. I'll find a nitrogen source, and then I'll find a potassium source. And then based on what the soil test tells me, then I'll add those particular nutrients. It's kind of hard to explain this without actually having examples up on the board to show you. If you had this situation in your soil, this is the fertilizer I would use. But when you do a soil test, if you ask the Extension Service to help you out with a commercial fertilizer, organic commercial fertilizer that'll work for you, they'll generally help you do that. And if you don't know, you can always give me an email and I'll do it for you.
Very good. Why don't you give them your email and so they can do that?
Again, it's Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G, at msu.edu. But a good garden always starts with a soil test report. Otherwise, you don't know what you need. And always remember that whenever you're growing plants on the ground, it's like making a withdrawal out of the bank. And I like to bring compost back in from materials that I compost in the yard. That adds nutrients. I'm always making deposits. And we even have kitchen scraps that we keep, and we have bins that we have worms turn it into compost, and then we use that also. So we try to use most of our organic matter, unless I'm in a bad mood and I just don't want to do it.
Well, folks, we've come to the end of another program, Good Growing with the Garden Guy, and we're really pleased to have the studio audience. You heard some of their questions, and Gary, I think we need to do a repeat of this.
Okay, we'll try.
Okay, we'll make an appointment for next year, the same time, same place. For our Strong Tower Radio Network, I'm Tom Majeure, Sue Majeure, and our host, Gary Heilig. Bye now.